exciting institute. And the topic I'm talking about today is still work in progress, so it's certainly not in a finished format as much as I would like. But then again, I hope this opportunity will bring, will give you the opportunity to comment and on it, and I hope we can have some nice discussions. Okay, here's roughly the outline of the talk. I'm sure I don't need to explain the concept of Bell inequalities to this audience. We all know that there are certain inequalities you can derive from a certain class of theories, which are, however, spectacularly violated by quantum mechanics. And therefore, the class of theories that obey the assumptions made in the derivation of these inequalities seem to be ruled out. And then it's only when the philosophical debates start running, because the question is then exactly, what are these assumptions that we made? What is their philosophical motivation? And so what type of theories are really ruled out by the failure or the violation of the Bell inequalities in quantum mechanics? Now, I think this debate is roughly three different positions, but I will come to that. And then I will talk about the usual derivation of the Bell inequalities, in which two main assumptions are usually distinguished, parameter independence and outcome independence. And then we will look in particular at the motivation for those assumptions, and most specifically, actually, perhaps only outcome independence, because that's the topic of my talk. I will then make a comparison with the notion of sufficiency that has been proposed much, much earlier in the 1920s in statistical inference. And I will try to argue that this criterion of sufficiency actually also provides a viable motivation for outcome independence, and motivation, moreover, that does not rely on locality. So one of the main claims I would like to propose is that outcome independence should not be seen as a formalization of a locality condition, but rather something, well, a sufficiency, or which is closely related to what some people also call completeness. So that's the main plan. And let me first try to summarize this debate about what is at stake in the Bell inequalities. There is what I take to be a received view, and that is that what you need to assume in order to derive the Bell inequality is some conjunction of a locality condition and realism. Sometimes people also use words like objectivity or causality, but it's not always clear how they are defined or what people understand by them. So I will focus here mainly on the terms locality and realism. As I said, this is more or less the received view, and that means that there are, yes?
So for me, the term locality is unclear. At some point, will you say what you mean by that?
Well, I will settle for a more or less pragmatic notion, and that means at least that you cannot signal arbitrarily fast over arbitrarily large distances.
Okay, so it's a causality. It's a causality.
If you want, that's a causality. But since there are distances involved, it certainly also has to do with locality. Yes?
There's also a related comment here, which I think is largely missed, and it's repeated in Bell's writings, that variables are actually present in the Copenhagen interpretation as it's usually perceived. What what Bell means by variables are just computer outputs, knobs and settings and those things. And that's what he calls the lambdas as well.
Well, we will get to that. Yeah, certainly.
So this is a clever move by Bell, because it's hard to deny the realism of these tables and chairs, knobs, settings, and so on.
Certainly.
So that's his starting point. So he, and this is the minimal realism he needs to get through with his argument, in fact.
Certainly. Yeah. But it is realism nevertheless. Well, we were getting a little bit ahead, I guess. If you take this received view, then
at least, of course, two options. You can either give up locality, or there seems to be still another option that you might give up realism. So on the received view, it's really not settled which way one should go if one wants to move forward. Nevertheless, there are alternatives. Of course, people have been trying to pinpoint the culprit, as it were, more closely. And Stapp and Eberhard have already argued in the 1970s that really it's just about locality, so that an assumption of realism is actually not needed to derive the Bell inequalities. Now, that argument has, at least in my mind, already been convincingly disputed or rebuffed. But recently, Tim Maudlin, Shelley Goldstein, and Norsen have sort of revived this point of view. And they consistently claim that it's just locality you need to assume, and that realism has nothing to do with it. On the other hand, there are also people who would go the other way. And for example, Leggett, in one of his recent papers, has argued that the violations of the Bell inequality, at least in his mind, have little to do with locality and much to do with objectivity or realism. So apparently, he would argue that you can deal with the violations of the Bell inequality by giving up on objectivity and maintaining locality. Now, I'm not in the position to settle this debate. This will presumably go on for decades in the literature. But what I will try to argue, and this is my main motivation here, is that there's a source of inspiration that has been overlooked. And that is this concept of sufficiency, which stems from the mathematical theory of statistical inference, and was formulated in 1922, long before the Bell inequalities were derived. And so it has sort of a respectable status about it. And in particular, I will argue that this can be used to motivate the assumption of outcome independence, and also some of the notions of completeness that you will find often mentioned in the context of the Bell inequalities. And actually, I will also, this is the second point I would like to claim, like to argue that this underlines, in a sense, that there is actually a substantial assumption of realism that you need. You need not only to assume that there are really existing variables, but also that they give this sufficient or complete specification of all there is in a particular mathematical sense. Okay, now here is what I assume to be roughly well known to all of you. So this is the PPR experiment. And I've just drawn it to introduce the notation. There are two particles which are born in some particular state produced by a source. There are two measurement devices which have particular orientations, alpha and beta, that can be set in a choice of different directions. And
if the particles pass through these polarizers, then they will produce an outcome which is either plus or minus one on both sides, and these are denoted by small a and small b. So what do we assume when we want to derive a Bell inequality? Well, we consider a very general model or class of models, and the only thing that we want to assume about these models is roughly the following. First of all, that there are variables called lambda, or also called hidden variables, that characterize the state of the particle pair as they are produced by the source. And the only thing that I need to assume about these variables is that they're mutually exclusive. That is to say, one or the other value of these variables holds, but not more than them, more two or more at the same time. And that capital lambda is a measurable space so that I can define a probability distribution over it. Furthermore, we assume that for every choice of the orientations alpha and beta, the model will specify a probability distribution for the outcomes A and B, conditionalized on the state of the particle pair. And the probabilities that are actually empirically accessible, the ones that we record in our measurement statistics, is obtained by averaging these probabilities by some probability density rho, which in principle might also depend on alpha and beta in the usual form that is dictated by probability theory. So that's the main first ingredient. The empirically accessible probabilities are obtained in this form. And then we demand three more technical assumptions. First, the probability distribution that characterizes the source should actually be independent of the choice of the orientations. And then secondly, there's outcome independence that states that if you conditionalize on lambda, actually the probability of the pair of outcomes A and B becomes a product. So A and B are conditionally independent once you specify the orientations and the hidden variable. The next assumption is usually called parameter independence, which means that these marginal probabilities of A and B are independent of the choice of the distance orientation, so depend only on the choice of the settings nearby. And if all that is in place, then you get the usual factorization condition, also called by Bell local causality. And once you have this assumption, then you can derive without further complications the Bell inequalities. I will not go into that because I assume that everybody has seen that many times. So these are the assumptions that go into the derivation of the Bell inequality. And now there's a whole list of remarks I would like to make. First of all, one might ask the question why we should distinguish between parameters and outcomes. I'm sure that Hans will be interested in the question. Many people don't make that distinction, and they treat the orientations alpha and beta on the same footing as the outcomes and the hidden variable lambda. And they use, actually Bell also uses that this notation. So alpha and beta are simply conditioning variables in the same way as lambda is. Now, you could do that, of course, but there's an important if formal objection to that. Namely, if you treat the orientations as conditioning arguments rather than as labels, parameters of the probability distributions, then what you're implicitly assuming is that your probability model also specifies probability for alpha and beta. Because you cannot conditionalize on something which is not also a random variable and therefore also has a probability. But that would be a most remarkable aspect of the hidden variable theory. Even quantum mechanics only gives us probabilities for outcomes to occur or for measurement results to be found if we specify what type of measurement we do. But quantum mechanics does not tell us how probable it is that Alice will choose a particular orientation, that she will make one measurement rather than another. So these type of probabilities are not contained in quantum mechanics. And it would be an unreasonable demand to assume that the hidden variable theory that we are studying does prescribe such probability. Yes?
Model. And suppose we cook up the Boyle-Bohm theory for the standard model, or a stochastic Nelsonian type of model. We do, I mean, some people believe that this is, you know, a fundamental theory, maybe not that fundamental, but it, at least it's capable of describing things like measurement devices and experimentalists, so on. And in such a case where you believe that the standard model of the Broglie-Bohm describes the complete scenario, it will prescribe probabilities for the experimentalist choosing this setting or that setting. So I would say if you go to the most fundamental level, that's what people would expect, or at least I would expect that the theory would give you probabilities of this thing. And also in Bell's writings, this is how he's treating it as well. He's treating the settings as probabilistic variables as well, at least in theory of local variables.
Well, there are just many things to remark. I don't deny that if you would take the most fundamental theory, if there was such a thing, then you could ask for a probability that Alice makes a particular measurement. And presumably, that theory will give you a probability for that. Also, of course, assuming that we have particular initial conditions that allow us to solve that question. So I'm not trying to deny that there are theories in which these probabilities can be. But what I'm saying is that we are trying to rule up, we're trying to develop an argument for as general a class of possible theories or models as we can imagine, as we can come up with. I'm not asking just about the most fundamental theory. I'm asking for a general class of theories, which all of which would be excluded by the fact that the other inequalities fall. And I'm trying to say that if I want to be as general as that, then for that purpose, it seems to be unreasonable for me to demand that the model should prescribe probabilities that even quantum mechanics does not prescribe.
Well, so the reason quantum mechanics cannot describe or prescribe them is that the Hamiltonian is not fixed, right? That's the only reason.
Because it's not a matter of the Hamiltonian. Quantum mechanics, at least in the way I understand that theory, tells you that if your system is described by a particular quantum state, and if you choose to perform a particular measurement, then there are such and such probabilities for particular outcomes. But quantum mechanics never tells us whether we will make this measurement or whether we will make that measurement. That seems to be up to the choice of the experimenter.
But if we believe in the standard model, we which most people don't, but I mean, at least to some approximation, then the Hamiltonian is fixed, and you know, the quantum state evolves in a new unique manner, modulo all infinities and so on. So and that would be the particle physicist point of view that, no, we are not really free to do any measurements. It has to satisfy.
I'm not denying
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
But I want to consider a general class of theories, not just the standard model or the type of theories that you were thinking of.
Just a comment on the comment. It seems, I think without any doubt, you'll get a more general theorem if you don't make this assumption. That's sort of just true by simple logic. But you might ask why you're interested in hidden variable theory, why you're interested in this theorem at all. And presumably the reason is that someone's not happy with quantum mechanics and this operational interpretation. They want what you might call a more intrinsic interpretation of quantum mechanics. And for those people, it might not seem at all natural to make this separation between the outcome independence and the parameter independence, because they're thinking of everything, including the instrument, as part of the same intrinsic, you know, the same objective reality. So you could argue that, although you weaken it a little bit in logic, it fits more with the kind of presuppositions that people have in mind when they are trying to analyze these hidden variable theories in the first place.
Well, it might be that people have in mind, but I'm just trying to be general and weaker than just that. If you want to treat the orientations as random variables, there's no formal objection to do that. And you could simply add some probability distributions over the pair values to the considerations. But I'm just saying you don't need to do that. Bell never does that. So I don't know, but I'm not, but certainly let's put one thing. I'm not trying here to give a literally and verbally faithful rendering of Bell's own writing. I'm trying to present what I think.
You say here by treating alpha and beta as conditioned arguments, but implies a probability distribution. Why does it imply? I mean, isn't that just a matter of notation and convention or other axioms?
Well,
because I would say it doesn't. I would say it's only when you allow the variable to jump over the bar that you imply such a thing.
Well, there's a very simple reason. If you write down a conditional probability in Kolmogorovian probability theory, that is defined as a
That way, then
yeah. So that means that there is if this probability is not defined, then you don't know what this means.
I can't remember exactly the comical graph seems. Is that really the definition?
That's the definition.
And there could be other sets of axioms that
certainly
additional probabilities.
Certainly, there are also those. Yeah.
I mean, I would have taken a better definition just a reading of what it suggests. You know, it's the probability of seeing A given B, which then wouldn't imply any distribution of a B.
Of course, well, of course, there are alternative sets of axioms for probability theory, but I wouldn't want to make the whole discussion of the Bell inequalities dependent on the choice of which type of probability theory you choose. And if it turns out to be dependent on that, that would be very, very, very interesting. Okay, so I'm just saying that I'm not assuming that the model will give us a probability for whether Alice chooses this or that setting of her orientation. And actually, I think that Bell also has that in mind when he says that these orientations are free variables. And I assume that he means by that the model shouldn't treat shouldn't prescribe their values or the probabilities of their values.
I just need to. So, in the theory of local variables, I'm sorry, the settings are given probabilistic treatment because they're just as the outcomes in these things. So, well, probably he's writing different stuff in his early writings, but in his later writings, these are just.
I am aware that Bell, in all of his writings, uses this type of notation, in which the alpha and the beta are conditioning states. But he never goes on to calculate their probabilities or to specify the probabilities. So, what I'm trying to say is he writes it in this way, but you could interpret it this way. And I think this is safer because it assumes less about the models that we want to discuss. Okay, there's another
remark, especially in the context of the debate about whether realism is necessary in the assumptions. I think that the very point of assuming that there is such a thing called lambda, which characterizes the state of the particles, is motivated by realism. And Bell, I think, also made that point by calling these variables beables, which he did to contrast them with observables. And to go into that a little bit more, it could be possible, of course, that if you take the philosophy of the Copenhagen point of view, that it would be impossible to describe such a, to give such a definite state of the particle pairs. Namely, that you would always have to include the measurement context and therefore the choice of the orientations into a specification like that. Now, of course, I know that even in the Copenhagen point of view, the quantum state could also be taken as a hidden variable, and that surprisingly makes no reference to the measurement context. But actually, I think that's somewhat of a miracle in Bohr's approach, because he always stresses that if you want to give a physical specification of what goes on in a particular measurement, you have to include the measurement context in order to give a description of what is real, of the phenomena, as he puts it. The quantum state for him is only a symbolical representation of that, of the state of affairs, which he doesn't interpret as a real, really existing quantity. But as I try to say, it's somewhat of a mystery, somewhat of a miracle, that it's possible if you insist that the measurement context also always plays an integral role in the specification of what is physically real, that it's possible to give a symbolical representation at all in which these measurement contexts do not appear. And what Bell, I think, so in a sense, of course, these assumptions are sufficiently general even to include the quantum state of orthodox quantum mechanics, but by calling these variables beables, I think Bell had in mind the idea that they simply exist, they are out there, and they do not depend on what we choose to observe or not, or what type of measurement we prefer to make. They're not dependent on the measurement context, and that's the basic realist assumption that goes into this idea. I hope that is clear. Now, there's one further comment, and that is that very often in discussions of this topic, you will find words that say that lambda is also supposed to give a complete or total or an exhaustive or a full specification of the state in question. But it's not really clear to me what that means, or how that is cashed out in the assumptions. And one might argue, perhaps, that on first sight, it's a very simple assumption. It simply means that lambda gives an inventory of all the properties of the particle pair, so that nothing is left out. And perhaps that's all you need. But then again, realize that we are trying to build up an argument that is supposed to cover a most general class of models. And then it doesn't take you long to realize that for every putative state space lambda, capital lambda, you can always envisage a class of possible worlds for which the state descriptions in that state space do provide a complete description, simply because we assume that there is nothing else in the world except these lambdas. And on the other hand, for each such state space, we can always envisage a larger state space, so that the former state space was actually just a coarse-grained description of this larger state space. And then lambda would be considered as an incomplete description, because now there is more to say about the model than we did in our previous state description. So whether or not you take lambda to be a complete or an incomplete description of the state turns out to be a somewhat arbitrary question. It depends on how large or how restricted you take your theory or your model to be. And since I want to discuss all the models in question, it's simply somewhat neither here nor there to ask whether such a model is complete or not, at least not if we don't have a more tangible sense for that notion. So let's ignore this for the moment. And well, there's perhaps also another remark I should make that I didn't write down. Lambda could also include variables that do not pertain to the particle pair in question. They might, in fact, also include hidden variables of the measurement apparatuses or other things that you want to consider might be a complete state of the world, if there is such a thing. All of this could be contained in lambda, and it really wouldn't make very much of a difference for my purposes, especially for outcome independence. I have to admit, of course, that for parameter independence, there are slight complications if you do that. But that will not be the main topic of my talk. So now let's go on to the motivations of the three technical assumptions I mentioned. And for the first two, at least for source independence and for parameter independence, there are straightforward types of motivations that you will find in most of the discussions of this topic, and I have relatively little to say on that. Source independence is often motivated by an invocation of the free will of the experimenters or some similar type of assumption. And well, as I said, I don't really want to go into that. Anything that motivates that the probability distribution of the lambdas does not depend on the choice of the orientations will do here. And for parameter independence, there's also a straightforward motivation, which is often discussed. It expresses a demand that the model will not allow superluminal signaling, even in principle. That is to say, if you could prepare a state with one particular value of lambda, then the measurement statistics you would get at Alice's side should not depend on the choice of orientation that Bob has made. Otherwise, Bob could alter his orientation and thereby change the measurement statistics on Alice's side. And therefore, even if they are in different galaxies, Bob could send a signal to Alice saying whether he loves her or not. Sure.
Straightforward. If the lambdas are uncontrollable,
yes,
then these cases of signaling can be washed out in the statistics.
That's right.
So in what sense is it straightforward?
Well, I did write down in principle.
So but how do you motivate? That's what I'm asking. It's consistent with, if the lambdas are uncontrollable, then there's no direct inconsistency with special relativity.
No, I'm not arguing here. I'm not referring to special relativity. So yes, it is true, of course, that if the condition that I just mentioned, that it's possible to prepare exactly one particular theoretical plot, it's possible that or conclude everything. It might be that the theory disallows it and says, no, you cannot prepare pure states of lambdas. You always have a particular distribution. And this distribution will be such that any signal you might want to send is actually washed out. And then there is this possibility in principle, which would then be disallowed in practice. So in that way, you can save consistency with special relativity. Absolutely. So the thing I'm trying to say here is that the assumption behind parameter independence is that no, in the particular types of models we are considering here, signaling is disallowed even in principle. Okay, but now I
do not pretend that there's nothing more to say about these assumptions, but for the topic of my talk, I want to go especially into outcome independence. And that has also traditionally been seen as a much more subtle and difficult condition to motivate. Jarrett was, of course, the first to introduce that notion, and he actually called it a condition of completeness and motivated it as follows, simply that saying that if all the information about particle one is included in the state description lambda, then knowledge of the outcome B provides only redundant information about particle one. So clearly, Jarrett is talking here about an information theoretical motivation for this condition, and claiming that if lambda is given, then an additional knowledge of B is irrelevant or only redundant for predictions about particle one. Now, Shimoni proposed this more neutral. That should be outcome independence, of course. But surprisingly, at least to me, Shimoni, in fact, also gives a different motivation for it than Jarrett does, and appeals also to a condition of locality, just like in the case of parameter independence. Although it's a different sense of locality, because it's not one that can be exploited to signal, but it would be some kind of, as he called it, passionate distance. But it would still be a non-locality of sorts, and that is to say, a violation of outcome independence. Many other authors have also looked into issues of locality or causality to motivate outcome independence, and particular popular lines of reasoning are an appeal to Reichenbach's principle of the common cause, or to Hellman's principle of stochastic Einstein locality. And you can find many papers who take that line. And for example, I also looked into a paper by Albie Harvey Brown and Sarah Foster. And there you find that Jared completeness, that is to say outcome independence, follows from natural assumptions about locality and causality. Berkovich, in his Stanford Encyclopedia article, writes, violation of outcome independence involves some type of holism, non-separability, and or passion at a distance that may be possible to reconcile with relativity theory. And so all of these authors seem to use a very different type of motivation for outcome independence, one that does not rely on this information theoretical analysis that Jared seems to have in mind, but search a motivation in terms of locality or causality or what have you. Norson is even more critical of Jared's ideas and says that the whole motivation behind his project is based on fundamental confusion. Nevertheless, I would like to argue for Jared's approach, and I will try to convince you that outcome independence can be seen as a particular instantiation of this notion of sufficiency that I already announced, and really that it should say that lambda gives a sufficient specification for the prediction of the outcomes A and B. And so, and I will also claim, or at least that's what I think, that this is also something that you should add to your realistic agenda, because it says that lambda is not just something that exists out there, but it has to give, in one particular precise sense, sufficient specification of the physical state. However, before I can continue, I want to make a remark that has already been made, I think, by many people in particular. But there's a warning, which is particularly important, not so much for this particular splitting of the assumptions in various sub-assumptions, but it is important if you want to decide which ones to give up or which ones to keep. And that is that the role of these assumptions may become different if you go from one model to another. So for example, let us consider a theory that not only specifies, well, we consider one theory that specifies the hidden variable lambda in the sense I've been talking about, but now consider an extension of that model in which there is a second hidden variable to be added to lambda, and the previous expressions are all derived by an additional averaging over a probability distribution of this second hidden variable. So we have sort of two levels. You can specify lambda, but you can also specify lambda and mu. And the question is then, what happens between these levels with outcome and parameter independence? If they hold at one level, do they also hold at other levels? And the answer to that question is rather simple. No, they do not. And that is because, well, these factorization type of conditions, independence conditions, are nonlinear, and therefore they do not remain intact under convex combinations. So you can have, say, outcome independence at the fundamental level, but not at the higher level, or you can have outcome independence at the intermediate level and not at the lower level, and all types of these combinations are possible.
And there are two striking examples of that phenomenon. You can take the orthodox quantum state as your hidden variable, the singlet state in the EPR experiment. And then you will find, as has often been pointed out, that parameter independence holds, but outcome independence fails. However, you can take the de Broglie-Bohm theory as an extension of orthodox quantum mechanics. You just use the same quantum state, now interpreted as a guiding wave. And you also add the positions of the two particles in question. And if you do that, you will find that parameter independence fails, but outcome independence holds. As it should, because it's a deterministic theory. Sort of similar phenomenon happens in Leggett's model that has been recently proposed, the non-local model. And Leggett uses three hidden variables vectors associated to the two particles. And if you use that full model, which is deterministic, then you will also find, of course, that, this should be outcome independence holds when parameter independence fails. And that's why Leggett's model was considered to be non-local. However, you can go one level higher and average out this one hidden variable that seems somewhat to be redundant. And then you get a stochastic model in which there are only probabilities. And for that model, parameter independence holds and outcome independence fails. So again, it's dependent on what type of level you want to study such a model, which of the two variables fails and which of the two variables holds. And so this is a warning that it's not guaranteed that if you hold on to parameter independence and give up on outcome independence, then you would somehow be okay. You should never be coming conflict with special relativity, as some people have argued, because it's possible that there is an underlying level in which this verdict is completely reversed, and it's parameter independence that fails and outcome independence that holds. So that's a warning that I wanted to make. And now I want to go over to the theory of statistical inference and tell you something about this notion of sufficiency. So I will sort of leave physics for the moment. And I'm now considering some arbitrary probabilistic experiment in which there are possible outcomes denoted as X. And there's a family of probability distributions, P, which are labeled by a particular parameter that can take values in some parameter space. And all of these probability distributions are candidate descriptions of the experiment. And the problem of statistical inference is to make an inference about which of these probability distributions would provide the best fit. So which value of theta would be the best choice on the basis of the outcomes that you actually observe in the recordings of the experiments. Now, it's usually convenient to consider a whole lot of identically distributed trials of such an experiment. And then, of course, you get a probability distribution like this. And in the theory of estimation that Fisher developed, the way to proceed about making such an inference is to design a function, an estimator, that's a function of these outcomes and takes values in the parameter set capital theta. And the value of tau would represent best estimate given the outcomes you observed. And now the question is, can
for estimation theories, can you give some sensible requirements on the construction or the design of such functions? Now, there is a simple way to go about that. You can, of course, think of different ways of representing these outcomes, which I here treat as if they are real values. That's not really necessary, but I just use that for the notation. And then on the space of all their values, you could think of a different coordinate system, values y1 to yn, and assume that that's a regular change of coordinates. Then whether you give the values of x1 to xn or the values of yn to 1n to yn is, of course, a completely equivalent way of specifying the outcomes in question. So you can look at the probability distribution in terms of these alternative coordinates. They're transformed like this with a Jacobian on the right-hand side. And now suppose that it comes out in this way, that one of these coordinates is singled out and that the probability distribution can be written in this way, which is to say there's only one factor depending on I1 and theta, and there's another factor depending on the other coordinates that, however, does not involve theta. In that case, Y1 is said to be a sufficient estimator for theta. And if that holds, it doesn't actually depend on the choice of the coordinate system. So if you had yet another set of coordinates, in which Y1 would also be one of them, then the same thing will hold there as well. So here is how Fischer interpreted this criterion of sufficiency. He said it's also called a statistic. It summarizes the whole of the relevant information supplied by the sample. And let me not read all of that. He says that, in other words, when y1 is known, knowledge of the values of any other function, y2, throws no further light on the value of theta. So again, this is sort of information theoretical motivation, saying that if you know y1, then any other function of the data is redundant or becomes irrelevant for the purpose of estimating theta, simply because their probability distribution does not depend on theta anymore. Now, here's a very well-known and simple example. If the family of probability distributions happens to be normal with a location parameter unknown, then taking the arithmetic average is a sufficient statistic. And this is, of course, well known. But in general, the question whether you can find sufficient statistics is severely limited. There's only a very limited class of probability distributions for which a sufficient statistic exists. And there are many cases in which you don't. So for statistical problems, it's very nice if you can find a statistical sufficient statistic. But in many cases, there simply is not such a thing. And then you have to get life without it. Of course, this has nothing to do with locality or causation whatsoever. It's simply a statistical notion that says that all the information you want about theta is summarized in a particular statistic, in the sense that all other functions of the data are independent of theta or do not throw any light.
Of two coordinates as well?
It's sometimes possible. Well, there's a generalized notion, of course, that I'm not sure if this is what you mean, that sometimes you cannot find one coordinate that is sufficient, but you can find a pair of coordinates for a triple, etc. Yes. Okay.
So I guess you will have already guessed that this sort of is connected, or I'd like to connect this to Jared's notions of completeness. But there's one important distinction in this orthodox treatment of statistics and in the case of the Bell inequalities, and that is that here we're trying to make an inference about theta, which is a parameter. And in the case of the Bell inequalities, we actually like to make an inference about outcomes, A and B. So I will have to change the perspective a little bit. And it's possible to do that by taking a Bayesian point of view on statistical inference. And in that case, one also assumes that there is an additional that there is an additional prior probability distribution over the parameter theta, and that all the probability distributions that are parameterized by theta can also be interpreted as conditional probabilities now conditionalized. And so in this case, there's really no longer any distinction between outcome and the parameter anymore. And once you do that, then of course it's also possible to invert the order of the conditionalization to come up with a sort of, with what is called the posterior probability distribution. And the goal of statistical inference, as it is conceived by Bayesians, is not to design an estimator, but to calculate this posterior probability distribution, that is the final probability you assign to this unknown value of theta once you have observed all the outcomes. And I want to note that although this is what I call the Bayesian approach to statistical inference, you should perhaps distinguish that from what is also often called the Bayesian viewpoint in the interpretation of probability, in which probabilities are seen as degrees of belief. I'm not necessarily presupposing that. I'm just presupposing this approach in which theta is also a random variable. Now, within Bayesian statistical inference, there is an equivalent condition for sufficiency, and it's, well, almost what you would expect. Y1 is a sufficient statistic just in case this condition holds, which again expresses that once you know Y1, then the values of all the other statistical functions become irrelevant for the probability you assign to theta. And again, this, of course, expresses the idea that all the information about theta is already captured by Y1. Now, I hope that it's now already clear how I would like to make the connection with Jared's condition. Here, I will simply propose that, well, it's perhaps clear on this page. For every choice of the orientations alpha and beta, I will assume that the hidden variable, which of course is actually not a datum in the sense of the outcomes recorded in the experiments, but since it's a beable, it has a particular value, so you can sort of make an hypothesis about how you would reason if you had that value. And the idea is simply that if you would know the value of lambda, then an additional specification of the outcome B
would simply not contain any new information for the prediction of the probabilities of A. And that is outcome independence in a different way. Of course, I can extend that idea also to other possible hidden variables and say that lambda should also be sufficient in the case of an extension of, by giving more hidden variables, and say that that probability distribution in now for all, for A and B, should also not depend on that extra specification. And I think that that is nice, because I said before that this notion that the state was a complete specification is actually somewhat fruitless and infertile notion in the derivation of the Bell inequalities, because it didn't have any formal expression. But with this in mind, it does have a formal expression. This is a nice way of saying that lambda gives a complete, or perhaps more prudently, a sufficient specification of all you need to know about the hidden variable space. Now, having said that, I will now come to my conclusions. And what I would first try to argue is that I think that this tradition of statistical inference has unfortunately been overlooked by most philosophers and physicists who have studied the implications of the Bell inequalities. I think that here we will find a much, well, in my mind, much more natural and fruitful way of analyzing some of the conditions in this derivation than in the literature on the principle of the common cause, for example. And since it also is 20 or what is it, 40 years of historical precedence, it's strange that nobody ever looked into this connection before. So I would say that considering sufficiency is something that pays off. And in particular, I would like to argue that the notion of outcome independence can be understood as saying that the hidden variable should be a sufficient specification for the prediction of the outcomes A and B. And that, in a sense, is of course exactly what I think what Jared had in mind. But, and therefore I see this as sort of a backing up of his viewpoint, but now by connecting it to this honorable tradition in statistics. I'm not sure if you would agree with me, but even if you would, then of course the first type of conclusion would then be that, well, this may provide some motivation for outcome independence, but that is not to say that it's the only motivation you can give, or even the most persuasive one. And perhaps one can argue, well, there's one way of motivating that condition by appealing to sufficiency. There's another motivation, perhaps, by appealing to locality or causality. So let us look for a moment in these alternative types of motivation. And well, since time is also running out, I will only look here into the principle of the common cause, which is due to Reichenbach. And it's a quite general statement for any type of events, A and B. They need not be connected to the EPR experiment here. But suppose you find two events, A and B, and they are correlated in the sense that their probabilities do not factorize. Then Reichenbach would say we have a correlation that cries out for explanation. And Reichenbach claimed that in any such case, you always exist some event C,
in the past A and B, such that once you conditionalize on C or its negation, you will find that the correlations go away and that the probabilities factorize in these two forms. And any event C that does that is said to be a common cause of the correlations. Now, there are many problems with the common cause principle that have also been pointed out by Johansson and various others. And most importantly, at least for my purpose, the problem is that you can ask, what happens if you make a more precise description and partition C into two or more sub-events? And the problem is then, of course, that any correlations which have just gone away might reappear for the very same reason that I mentioned before. Factorization conditions like these are not linear and therefore not preserved under convex combinations or decompositions. So here's an example that I stole from Elby and Brown and Foster's paper. There are N and Bill who live on opposite sides of Rainy Mountain, and they find that sometimes their basement is flooded, and there's a correlation between these floodings, because when N's basement is flooded, Bill's basement is much more likely to be flooded than if you don't conditionalize on N's floodings. So there is this correlation that, according to Reichenbach, needs to be explained. And there is an explanation, because it might happen that there is a rainstorm on the previous night, and that we find that if you conditionalize on this event that there had been a rainstorm, the correlation between the floodings goes away. So you would be happy, it seems, because now you found a common cause of these correlations. And yet, it might still be the case that rainstorms can be divided into various types, say heavy rainstorms and light rainstorms, and that even if the rainstorm takes away the correlation between the floodings, it might happen that that's actually due to the fact that there is positive correlation for heavy rainstorms and that there is a negative correlation for light rainstorms, and that rainstorms are sometimes heavy and sometimes light, and that on average, these positive and negative correlations wash out to produce no correlations. So that it seemed like you have an explanation for the absence of correlations, but if you look more closely into the matter, you will find that the correlations reappear. This is an example of what is sometimes called the Simpson paradox. Now, would it be reasonable in such a case to call a rainstorm the common cause of the correlation? Well, I don't think so, because, as I said, there might be further correlations if you look closer into the matter. And if you want to follow Reichenbach's intuitions, then these correlations need to be explained again. So you have to find a further common causes, but then if you have to explain them, you're not guaranteed that if you did not look further into the matter, the correlations might reappear, and it seems like you have to embark on a never-ending search. Well, of course, this did not escape L.B. Brown and Foster in their analysis of the common cause principle and its relation to Jared completeness. So they added another condition to the common cause principle. And they said that, well, it's, remember that R is the specification of rainstorm on the previous night. And they add, it's only when we build into R a statistically complete description of the rainfall, the wind patterns, the drainage conditions, et cetera, then we expect that R is the Reichenbachian common cause of A and B.
in words, given a full description of the rainstorm, the probability of Bill's basement flooding will not be lowered or raised by the additional information that Anne's basement is flooded. Information about Anne's basement is redundant or irrelevant. Again, these informational theoretical notions, once we possess the precise weather information contained in R. So we need something more than that's just specified by the common cause principle. We need a statistically complete description. So then the question, of course, is now what is meant by a statistically complete description? Now, if you look in the L.B. Brown and Foster paper, the definition of that concept is somewhat involved because it actually seems to demand a condition, a relation between the probabilities and actually observed frequencies, which I think is somewhat of a red herring, because that's a question of whether the theory is empirically adequate, which I would like to keep separate here. But there is a corollary of their definition, which is more to the point, I think, and that is simply this. A theoretical description is statistically complete if, or consequence of that notion is that there is no conceivable way of splitting an ensemble into sub-ensembles with different measurement statistics. So that is to say, once you consider an ensemble of states, of systems with exactly the same state, there is no way of splitting such an ensemble in sub-ensembles that have different statistics for the outcomes A and B in any conceivable way. Now, of course, there's another question then, what is a conceivable way? But I don't have to go into that, because if the factorization did not hold, this factorization, then clearly, by specifying whether Bill's basement has flooded or not, we will be able to select two sub-ensembles with different outcome statistics for Anne's one. So by demanding that the state description is statistically complete, we don't actually need to infer Reichenbach's principle of common cause. We have already guaranteed it's true. It's not a merit of the common cause principle. This condition of statistical completeness, which of course is very, very similar to the notion of sufficiency, by itself guarantees the factorization in question. So in the motivation of this type, what it seems to me like is you're trying to give an argument that outcome independence is motivated by an appeal to locality or causality in the principle of common cause. But what's actually used is only this notion of complete statistical completeness, that is to say, sufficiency. And so the principle of common cause is actually redundant in the whole analysis. Yes?
This because you're leaving out the as far as I can see, you're leaving out the temporal aspect. And the idea is that what has to be complete is a complete description of the past, or enough of the past. So it doesn't imply a complete description of the whole history, including the future. And then I don't think it reduces to a tautology. I think that's the whole,
that's
essence of the argument.
That's a good point. That's a good point, and that is another problem of the whole common cause principle, and also perhaps with it in this analysis.
Reichenbach's common cause principle is not formulated into a space-time background. And that is one of the major, also one of the main conceptual obstacles. And for example, it's also often used in cases when there is no space-time background, like to begin with. For example, in evolution trees, things like that.
I see, but then my point is that the different principles that did have the space-time background, and then I think it would give a good independent motivation for this.
Yes.
Some independence.
Well, there are many alternatives to consider in this case. But what I'm just trying to say right now is that this particular way of appealing to a causality principle, or principle of common cause, is only appealing because it presupposes a condition of completeness, which is, in my mind, similar or identical to the notion of sufficiency. And so it's not really an alternative motivation. It's only when you presuppose sufficiency that you can think of outcome independence as expressing locality or causality. But then that, of course, invites the question, is why do you think of it as an expression of causality or locality if you could also think of it as expressing just
be supposed to,
namely sufficiency.
Yeah, I have an example that I think may clarify, but I don't want to interrupt. Are you finished now?
I'm at the brink of finishing. I'm just, trying to wrap up. Well, let me, in the end, come back to Bell. It has already been pointing out that Bell didn't seem to like this breaking up of his factorization condition into the subconditions of parameter independence and outcome independence. For him, it was sort of a package deal that would not be split into parts. And it has sometimes been argued that he didn't make any substantial assumption of realism or completeness in his way of presenting the argument. But I think that overlooks the major aspects of his writings. First of all, of course, the whole theory, the whole assumption of local causality was formulated in what we call the theory of Beables. And as I argued, these Beables are an explicit reminder of that we need to make a realist assumption. These are things that exist out there. But he also, especially in his last paper on La Nouvelle Cuisine, he did stress the condition of completeness very much in his. Here's a quotation from that paper. He tries to describe what he means by a local causality. He says the theory is said to be locally causal if probabilities attached to the values of local variables in space-time region 1 are unaltered by a specification of the values of local variables in space-like separated region 2. When one happens in the backward Lie cone is already sufficiently specified. For example, by a full specification of the local variables in space-time region 3. And now, here it comes. He says, it's important that the events in 3 are to be specified completely. Otherwise, the traces in region 2 of the causes in events in 8 could well supplement whatever else is being used for calculating probabilities about 1. The hypothesis is, and I think that you should read this, the hypothesis of completeness is that any such information about region 2 becomes redundant when region 3 is specified completely.
Well, this is exactly the assumption of sufficiency. Of what it means that specification of region 3 is sufficiently specified. So it's not that Bell doesn't use that argument. He explicitly points out that that hypothesis is needed. And a little later in his paper, he writes about, well, this is with capitals are added here, but he says, evoking local causality and the assumed completeness of the hidden variables, we have this factorization. So for Bell, too, it was not just about local causality. Completeness, in a particular sense of the word, is a necessary ingredient in the argument. And that's just what I've also been trying to argue. Completeness, or as I would prefer to call it, sufficiency, is an important ingredient in the argument. And I would therefore like to back up Jarrett's analysis against people who think that it is merely a locality condition. And that's my main message. So thank you very much.
So let's just take a few questions. So, Bobby?
I'm going to question not so much whether completeness, the notion of completeness of sufficiency, is relevant to you. I think that's absolutely clear. It's whether it's sufficient. Yes. I mean, the intuition in the paper that I wrote with Albion and Foster was basically the following, and we've talked about this. If you take quantum mechanics and assume that there are no hidden variables, so you have maybe something like a no-collapse, or something like an Everett picture, or some other interpretation that has no hidden variables, there's a sense in which the theory is complete. But the theory violates conditional outcome independence. Now, that notion of completeness that we tried to formalize using this von Neumann notion of homogeneous ensembles, for example, is a very strange business, because in quantum mechanics, if you think of a singlet state, before any measurements are performed on either system, if quantum mechanics is complete, it's telling you that those ensembles of systems of each individual, at each wing of the experiment, there's no rule that guarantees the choice of a sub-ensemble, sub-ensembles which have different statistics from the ones predicted by the theory. The theory also predicts, so in that sense it's complete, in the von Neumann sense, the statistical completeness sense. The theory also predicts that if you do measurements on one system, that condition will be violated for the other system. Now, does that mean that the theory was incomplete to start with? You see, seems to be the wrong conclusion. The theory doesn't have any hidden variables. It says everything there is to say dynamically. And yet it's violating in this very strange way the conditional outcome independence.
Exactly. I think the diagnosis has to be that the word completeness has been a little overworked in these discussions. There are too many connotations with that, going back to Einstein and Podolsky-Rosen and so on. Yes, of course, if you take sort of the Everett interpretation, then the quantum state is complete in the sense that there is really nothing more to say about the system than it's quantum state. So it sums up all there is to know about the system before the measurements. And in this ontological sense and in a dynamical sense, perhaps one could call it complete. But it's not informationally complete in the sense that, as you just said, if you look at the probability of one particular outcome, you can learn more if you know the outcome of another experiment, then by just looking at the quantum state. So that is another notion of completeness in which it's not complete. And trying to capture both of these notions by using the same word, I think, will only lead us to
but given the
that's what a second argument, right, not only the historical precedence, but why not use a word like sufficiency, which seems to be more modest than completeness anyway.
But given the success of quantum mechanics, why would we want to impose this stronger condition on some hypothetical theory?
The stronger condition?
Well, the condition of sufficiency. You're saying quantum mechanics in one sense, but it's insufficient in another sense. But given its success, why would we demand the stronger condition of sufficiency?
Well, I'm talking about assumptions needed to derive the building quality. And of course, you can always say, given the success of quantum mechanics, and quantum mechanics violates building qualities, why not stick with quantum mechanics? Of course, and then we don't have to look at these alternative theories anyway. But we're trying to learn something about alternative possibilities that might be out on the market as things that could replace quantum mechanics. And in those theories, well, I'm not saying particularly that you should buy or accept sufficiency or outcome independence as a dogma. So it's only that if you assume that, then you derive well inequalities, and then of course you're out of the game because things are violated. So the thing you learn in the end is, of course, that, well, maybe what you should look at theories that do not satisfy outcome independence or that do not satisfy parameters.
Yeah, so I'm not sure if this how to formulate this. So it's going to say something like the condition of sufficiency that you put up. You said, well, this can replace the causality, but it seemed to me like the only motivation for the sufficiency you actually used would be causality itself, because you're saying something like this. Maybe this is, I've got some confusion, but you were saying that once you've got the variable lambda, then you need nothing more to specify the state. Now, what if I was to say, oh well, to get the outcome for B, maybe the correct way of writing down sufficiency is that I leave lambda and A, because A might happen before B in some foliation of the space-time. So I could say, oh, that's sufficiency. And that's something slightly weaker, but the only reason not to say that for me would be, oh wait, I want to use the relativistic causal structure, I don't want to assume anything about A, because albeit that it's in the past of B in some foliation, I'll say it's not in the past of B using the relativistic causal structure. So it seemed like it sort of presupposed some kind of relativistic causal structure, that way of writing the sufficiency.
I'm not quite sure. Although I do admit that it would be very interesting if you can find a formulation of sufficiency that would embed, or discussion of the topic, which would be completely embedded into the causal structure of, say, Minkowski space. But the fact remains, I think, that one can formulate this condition without reference to this background, as it is done in statistical theory. Remember that in the context of estimation theory, we could be talking, well, about, say, the weight of a tomato in a certain breeding experiment, and talk about and ask which are sufficient statistics in that case. And then nobody would think about the causal structure of space-time in that context.
Well, yes, you can write down, but then it's how the condition is applied, is it not? So that what thing you consider is the sufficient variable, whether it's just this lambda, whether it's some other set of things. So that's where the causal structure comes
from. But again, remember, what I said, and it also specified Bell, by the way, is that lambda doesn't need to be localized. And you might include in lambda all the hidden variables, not only of the pair of particles, but also the measurement apparatus and so on everywhere. So it might be that you specify everything in the region here, and then still there is this outcome B over here, which would change or would
influence. Why not specify B as part of lambda too?
Exactly.
Why
Why not A and B as part of
that?
But the point is that...
How do you know where you where it's natural physically to draw the line? There you're using...
There is no natural way
of doing structure of the space-time.
Of course, you can include that as well. But then the point is probably that you don't get a condition. If you consider this inclusion, you don't get a condition that has any bite in the argument anymore.
Right. Yeah. So I suppose that's the point. Or maybe we agree. Because if you do that, you lose. You can no longer derive the quality. Mm-hmm. But then how do you rule out that from? So why does sufficiency not say that? Well, only after you've admitted the causal structure and said, "Oh, this isn't really the condition I want."
Yeah, I think
that. Well, certainly, I'm not trying to. Of course, if in trying to formulate sufficiency, of course, you want to be as parsimonious as you can. Of course, if you state everything about the entire history of the universe, so on, of course, that will be sufficient specification. Right? If you include everything, but the search, of course, is for parsimonious description, so that you can say, oh, now I have a description, and you might add anything else to it, but that really wouldn't change my description because that's just redundant information. So you want to compress and find as small a description as possible that will still be sufficient. And that's one of the reasons why you want to not use the well, go back to smaller subset.
Maybe we should sort of go over to the prior discussion. Thank you, Yossi, at this stage. Thank you.